Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome a great guest co-host today, one of our great residents at UNC Family Medicine, Dr. Roberto Rupcich. Welcome, Roberto.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, we're going to be talking today with a great guest, Dr. James Doty, professor of neurosurgery and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research at Stanford University. Yes, a neurosurgeon, director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research. We heard it right. I'm looking forward to that conversation.
I am as well.
But first, we've got some research that matters. And our very first one, actually, we could probably even ask our guest about, but it's about the relationship between potentially conflict with our spouse and chronic pain.
This was pretty interesting to me because we know a little bit about how a couple in a satisfying marriage usually tends to have better health outcomes, both physically and psychologically. But this gives us a little bit of a hint as to how a negative relationship or people that are having some fights in the marriage can potentially lead to worse outcomes in their diseases.
Yeah, this was an article that was actually the Annals of Behavioral Medicine. And they did two studies. One was 145 patients with arthritis in the knees and their spouses. And the other was 129 patients with type 2 diabetes in their spouses. And in both studies, participants kept daily diaries about their mood, the severity of their symptoms, and kind of the interactions with their spouses. Were they positive or negative? And this went on for 3 or 4 weeks. And then they looked at the types of outcomes. What did they find?
So sure enough, they found that within both groups of the participants, patients were in a worse mood on days when they felt more tension than usual with their spouse. And this in turn led to the greater pain or severity of their symptoms.
Yeah, and I kind of wondered, was it the worsening pain that was causing the worsening relationship, or was it the worsening relationship that was causing worsening pain? We don't really know which was going on, do we?
That's exactly the question here, because this could be a cycle. One can obviously see how being in worse pain can lead to a potential altercation with your spouse.
Yeah, I mean, I know that it's hard to separate out physical from psychological health. And I know as family doctors, we tend to want to understand both because we know how both affect. And I think this just really shows that even with something like diabetes, which should be pretty straightforward, it's not so straightforward. And we have to pay attention and our listeners have to pay attention to those relationships because probably if the relationship improves, the chronic disease may also improve.
Correct. And I think this will probably tie into the theme that we'll be discussing later today with Dr. Doty. Have a little bit of compassion for your spouse.
Good idea. We're going to both practice that when we get home, right?
All right.
Let's talk about our next research that matters. And this actually comes from the University of North Carolina. At least it started there. And it's about male hormones, male fertility. What are we talking about here? There's not really a male fertility drug, is there?
Not yet. So if you're a man and you are looking for contraception, you're pretty much limited to wearing condoms or getting a vasectomy. Those are your two options right now that are, for the most part, pretty reliable if you use condoms properly. But now here we have a pill that may be coming on the market at very early stages. Simply put, this is a compound that is going to completely take away your sperm's ability to swim. And as we know, if sperms can't swim, it's very hard to become pregnant.
And this was research that was published in the journal PLOS One, PLOS One, and it's a new compound called EPO55 that binds to the sperm protein. And just as you said, Roberto, it affects the motility of the sperm. And they say it didn't have other side effects. And this was developed by researchers who were at the UNC School of Medicine and left, but it formed a company then called Epen Pharma after the name of this protein. And this particular research actually was done in animals right now. It hasn't been done in humans yet. So we don't really know, is it going to work? And are there really going to be potential side effects? Because I would be worried about potential side effects. How easy would it be for the men's sperm to come back? They say in the monkeys, I think that it's okay.
Right. It came back in the monkeys, apparently here about 3 weeks after the monkeys were given an IV infusion of this medication, the sperms were back to normal, happy swimmers.
Which is a good idea. We don't know what happens after you've been on the drug for 3 years.
Exactly.
And so, we have to have an IV infusion. But this is early stage. We found it kind of exciting because there's very little out there. And I think a lot of men, a lot of partners would be really interested in this when and if it makes it to the market.
I agreed.
The fact it comes out of the University of North Carolina is just an added bonus.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't hurt. Well, let's talk about our next research that matters. And this is something that our program, actually, the University of North Carolina, does weight management. And a lot of people around the country who are interested in losing weight, I've heard about it's fasting diets.
I was pretty interested in this article because I don't have too much time to spend at the gym. So I was looking at some quick YouTube advice, and I find this guy with over a million followers who is basically recommending that you go ahead and fast every other day. And sure enough, this article gives us an idea here that fasting every other day may result in some weight loss, but there may be some additional damaging side effects.
Yeah, this was research presented at the European Society of Endocrinology. And we get asked a lot, do we recommend, you know, fasting or not? Is there any problems with it? And it's very early on, but it suggests that you could lose some weight, but there could be actually damage from what is called free radicals, things that form when the pancreas perhaps changes and is deprived of food and it alters insulin function. This could actually be damaging to the body, and it certainly raises concerns, I think. So, you know, if one is doing some fasting periodically, maybe okay, but perhaps fasting regularly as part of a weight loss strategy may not be a good idea. I don't know. That's my take home.
I agree.
We need a lot more research before I think we can recommend it unequivocally. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show, and we're going to take a short break. And when we return, Roberto and I will be talking to Dr. James Doty, professor of neurosurgery and director and founder of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research at Stanford University, about the relationship between doing good and good health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Roberto Rubchich. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, Roberto, we're talking with Dr. James Doty, professor of neurosurgery and director and founder of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research at Stanford University, about the relationship between doing good and good health. Welcome, Dr. Doty.
It's a pleasure to be with the two of you. Thank you for having me.
We're incredibly excited because this is a topic that's so near and dear, not only to primary care and family medicine, but really all of medicine and all of society. And I'm sure that's in part what you have set out to do. But I guess first, we'd like to know a little bit about you. How did you get interested in medicine, then neurosurgery, then taking on the world?
Well, that's probably more time necessary than we have. But briefly, I grew up in a challenging environment with a father who was an alcoholic and a mother who had had a stroke when I was a child and was chronically depressed and, in fact, had attempted suicide multiple times. Neither had gone to college. We were on public assistance, and essentially my entire childhood or living at home. And, of course, we know those situations are referred to as adverse childhood experiences, which now is a very active area of research, which demonstrates that when individuals, children grow up in those types of environments with poverty, mental health issues, addiction issues, violence, the likelihood for them to having success in life is quite limited. I was fortunate in that there was an individual who really changed my life. And the way she changed my life was actually connecting with me and teaching me techniques that allowed me to harness my own anger and hostility and despair and sense of hopelessness and to see the world in a different way. And when I saw the world in a different way and reacted to it in a different way, then the world changed how it reacted to me. And I developed the confidence that it was possible to be anything or do anything. I was fortunate in that in fourth grade, we had a physician, a pediatrician, visit my classroom. And after meeting him, he was so kind. He treated every child like they were an adult in the sense that he listened to them, responded to their questions without talking down to them. And I was so impressed with just the sense of kindness and actually compassion to those around him that at that moment I decided to be a doctor. But of course, becoming a doctor from the background I had is far different than a lot of people from more privileged backgrounds. If you don't have mentors, if you don't have access, if you don't have, frankly, wealth, that makes it more challenging. But I was fortunate because of the tools that this woman taught me. And I talk about this in a book that I wrote, a memoir that includes neuroscience and what we call contemplative practice or meditation called Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain and the Secrets of the Heart, which actually became a New York Times bestseller. And it, believe it or not, is now translated into 31 languages.
Wow.
But with that underpinning of giving me confidence, allowing myself to be self-compassionate, which then allowed me to be compassionate with others or towards others, and also understanding how to manifest my intention, all of those things allowed me to move forward in my life, to go to college, to attend medical school, and ultimately to become a neurosurgeon, a faculty member at Stanford, and found the center. And the founding of the center related to this paradox that many of us see, which is there are people around us who have wealth, position, means, and they see people suffering or in need, and they do nothing. And then, of course, we see people who have nothing who give everything. And what is it about those situations that make others engage to help others? And that paradox stayed with me, and I was finally in a position where I could explore it further. And ultimately, that led to the founding of the center. And the center, actually, the initial benefactor is the Dalai Lama.
Wow.
Fascinating. By the way, I have made my Amazon Prime purchase this morning. So I have your book, Into the Magic Shop, coming in this Wednesday. I'm very excited to read it. I actually caught the preview, the introduction, and you had me on the edge of my seat this morning. So I look forward to reading your book here. I do have a question for you. Can we quickly define what we mean when we say compassion and altruism, specifically in terms of clinical research?
Well, as you point out, to do research, you have to have definitions. And in that context, we use the term compassion to mean a motivational desire to alleviate suffering. So you have to recognize the suffering in another and have a motivational desire to alleviate. It doesn't mean you're able to always, but your desire is to do so. Altruism is a motivational desire to assist or care for another, and that action potentially comes at a cost. As an example, if you were to see a child drowning and you jumped in this rapidly flowing river, you're putting yourself at risk when you try to save that child. So that's altruism. The other is that, as an example, you could even take it down the path of you donated a significant amount of money, which means you don't have that money, to a cause that benefits others. Now, that gets a little more challenging because a lot of the motivational desire, unfortunately for many people, is a tax write-off, which obviously you do get something, and it's not necessarily costing you anything in the sense because you would have to pay taxes on it anyway. And then there are even people who argue that there's no true altruism because anytime you do an act towards another, you receive the benefit of what's called the warm glow or this positive feeling that occurs, this pleasurable sense when you do something for another person.
So let me ask a question, because as physicians and colleagues, we know that when we're looking at the next generation of medical students that will become practicing providers, that altruism is almost like a given. If you're not altruistic, you're in the wrong field. But yet, compassion and empathy, we hope to really see and cultivate. Are they things that can be increased? Do we know that training makes a difference? Because I know you do training on compassion.
Yes, and the answer to your question is yes. Now, I would argue with you. Unfortunately, I believe, and it's been my sense and my experience, that there are some people who go into medicine not for the right reasons. Either they have been raised to seek a job with security, or they want prestige. Now, I'm not saying that's the majority, but that's certainly a significant percentage of people. And in fact, frankly, most medical schools, they don't screen for people to be more compassionate or kind, frankly, at all. Most don't. They say that. What they screen for is how high is your GPA and what clubs have you belonged to that demonstrate you're sort of doing kind things. But oftentimes, people know how to game the system, especially if you're wealthy and you have access and you have tutors and you have mentors. And I'm not saying that in a critical way, but it's a reality. But I think what we are seeing more and more is a desire to incorporate those characteristics into our new medical students. So we can potentiate an individual's compassion. All of us have a genetic possibility, whether it be for compassionate behavior or athletics, and we have demonstrable techniques. We have a compassion cultivation course, as an example, that we've developed over many years and has been validated, that actually teaches you to be more compassionate to yourself, because we know many people in the caregiving professions are very hard on themselves. And it teaches you to be more thoughtful and practice compassion with intention. As an example, unfortunately, in our modern healthcare environment, where we have very limited amounts of time to see patients, we make decisions quickly, we have healthcare extenders, oftentimes patients feel rushed and not listened to. In fact, I had a patient telling me just the other day how she went to see a colleague, and he introduced himself, then sat at the computer and started asking questions and never looked at her. And she was saying how she felt he wasn't even there. He didn't really care. It was all about getting his stuff into the computer. And that's a sad part of the situation now. We do know, though, if you touch a patient, if you lean toward them when you're talking to them, if you're present and give them the sense that you're not rushed, it has huge, huge benefits, because when a patient comes to see a physician, they're already anxious. And oftentimes that anxiety results in them not really listening. They're thinking about the negative possibilities of the interaction. But when you sit there and you calm them, you shift them from the engagement of their sympathetic nervous system to their parasympathetic nervous system, which is our rest and digest mode. You have access to your executive control function. You're more discerning, thoughtful. You take more information in. You're actually more creative, and ultimately, you're more productive. So this works on both sides of the equation, towards the patient and towards yourself. In fact, we give our course to medical students, residents, fellows, and faculty, because as you're very well aware, there is an epidemic of anxiety, stress, and depression in the healthcare profession at all levels. And in fact, there's a large percentage of medical students who are depressed on medication, and that just goes forward in the context of their training. And we have a significant number of faculty who are very unhappy with the present situation because they feel this is not what I signed up for. So while these techniques are not meant to take the place of a nurturing, caring environment, they do potentially, though, give you a toolbox and some tools that allow you to deal with the situation. But ultimately, we need to revise what the profession of medicine is in the modern day world, both for us as human beings and certainly for our patients.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to pick up, I think, on this toolbox and how you're applying it, not just in medicine, but really across other institutions in society. We'll be taking a short break, and then we'll return talking with Dr. James Doty, professor of neurosurgery and director and founder of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research at Stanford University, about the relationship between doing good and good health. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking to Dr. James Doty, professor of neurosurgery and director and founder of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research at Stanford University, about the relationship between doing good and good health.
And we've been kind of talking about this toolbox. And, you know, I was just thinking, Dr. Doty, of a conversation I've had recently about it's so frustrating for me as a clinician to know that this compassion is doable, and it doesn't have to take so long, but even in healthcare, it seems difficult to start and teach and role model that the first 15 to 30 seconds of every encounter should be role modeling what you're teaching. How do we transform it to insist that that paradigm be followed?
Well, I think it has to do with the will of the institution, and this also falls into the domain of business, civic government, and really all areas of life. If we pick individuals to lead organizations that are solely looking at the bottom line or how productive or how profit-making every encounter is, then we have a problem. And that has been the tendency. What we need to do is to combine individuals who have compassionate instincts and actually leadership abilities and the ability to lead organizations as well as people, and put them in charge, and then the paradigm starts changing. It's much more difficult when it's the bottom of the organization that's suffering, and they're trying to just survive in a difficult situation, and the entity does not give the resources that allows people to take advantage of what science shows us, that being compassionate both to yourself and those around you, or in the context of an organization, creating a compassionate organization, it changes everything. And it's a very, very cost-effective way. Being kind and compassionate to another person costs absolutely nothing. And it creates the environment, though, that allows people actually to function at their best. As a species, we evolved fundamentally to be nurturing and kind. So I think any action you do that can decrease stress and anxiety, and you can imagine seeing a neurosurgeon create stress, it's beneficial. And even in the context of, as an example, wound healing, if a patient is not stressed during the healing process, they heal faster. And in fact, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this study, and this was in the context of an emergency department with individuals who were frequent revisitors, if you will. The simple act of training the physician staff and the nurses to interact with them compassionately and kindly and showing them dignity resulted in a 50% decrease in readmissions. Can you imagine?
That's amazing.
I like the cost of that one, definitely.
So what I'm hearing here is there's a cycle where stress and anxiety pretty much prevents you from being compassionate, but if we were to be a little bit more compassionate, perhaps, we would reduce our stress and anxiety. So short of taking your compassionate cultivation course, what would be perhaps an easy step one for our listeners and for even myself, because now I'm finishing my second year of residency and I'm finding myself increasingly stressed out about perhaps the number of patients that I have to see in a day. And I can see it. There's days where I feel a little bit less compassionate. And that's very unfortunate because, as you mentioned earlier in the show, I don't want to end up as one of those physicians that says, this is not what I signed up for. So how do we help ourselves kind of break this cycle where stress and anxiety is just crushing our ability to be compassionate?
Well, it's interesting when you said, well, short of taking your course, you know, there's a Buddhist monk that said one time, if you don't feel you have 20 minutes a day for meditation, it means you should be doing an hour a day. And what that means is that there's always time to take a bit of time. Like what I do every morning is I sit by the side of my bed and I breathe slowly in and out and I'm thankful for being alive. Simply doing that starts setting an intention. And then what I do is I used to meditate a great deal. And while I still meditate, I don't nearly do it with as much time because I can get the effect not only from having done it, but from another practice that, in fact, I began after I was asked to speak at the white coat ceremony at my medical school. And I'm sure you know what that is, where you take the oath of Hippocrates or whatever oath is taken.
Do not
given a white coat. Yes, and that's the introduction to you into the medical profession. And I tried to reflect on what is it that I can give these medical students that will not only set their path forward to remember on how to be your best self as a physician, but also as a human being. And, of course, we use mnemonics oftentimes in medical school to remember and learn things. And so what I shared with them was a mnemonic that's 10 letters of the alphabet. It is the one that I use every day, and it sets my intention. And the first letter is C, having compassion for self and others, recognizing the dignity of every person, practicing E is equanimity, an evenness of temperament throughout the ups and downs of your day, practicing forgiveness, not holding that anger that you get sometimes towards others, G, having gratitude. Remember, most people in the world live on less than $2.50 a day. So wherever we're at almost, we're better off than the vast majority of people. H is having humility, which oftentimes for a neurosurgeon is challenging. I is having integrity and values that you live by. Justice in the context of fairness and our responsibility for caring for those who are most vulnerable. K is practicing kindness, all contained by love. And in fact, what I do every day is throughout the day, I try to take a pause, really sometimes for only a minute and a half or two, and sit with one of those letters and just think about it. And the very nature of doing that interrupts your day and resets your intention, if you will. And for me, that has become a daily practice that really significantly decreases the stress that I have in the day. And hopefully allows me to always connect with my colleagues and patients with kindness and compassion. Because when I do that, they feel better, they heal better, and their length of stay is shortened, and their readmission rate is decreased. And again, very cost-effective way to do that. We know that when you practice compassion with intention, that it has a profound, profound effect on your health. It shifts you from this sympathetic nervous system mode of fear and anxiety to your parasympathetic mode, which is your rest and digest system. It allows for more thoughtful decision making because you have access to information, because your executive control area is functioning at its best. You're much more creative. You're more thoughtful and productive. You're not disengaged from your work. And it also affects the immune system. It affects cardiac function. We know that when you have a decrease in heart rate variability, which is associated with stress, that this actually is associated with sudden cardiac death. And when you're in your rest and digest mode, you have an increase in heart rate variability. Your heart actually is functioning better. Your peripheral vascular system functions better. Your blood pressure is lowered. And markers of stress, such as cortisol levels or interleukin, and other markers are decreased. And in fact, what's extraordinary is even with a brief sitting with intention to be more compassionate, there is a decrease in the epigenetic expression of inflammatory proteins, which, as you know, is associated with a lot of chronic diseases. So on every level, because it is so hardwired within us, when we act compassionately towards the other and towards ourselves, it has a profound effect not only on you, but the environment around you.
You know, Dr. Doty, this is really quite amazing. And I think the impact of your words on others is profound. And I wonder if you could just, in our last minute or so, tell us about the impact of the Dalai Lama on you.
Well, people always ask me what it's like to be in the presence of the Dalai Lama. And I can certainly say it's quite extraordinary. But what I would share with you is the following. As we know, there are places in the world called blue zones, and these blue zones are places where people traditionally live over a century. And interestingly enough, in some of them, people smoke, they drink, etc. But the absolute most important thing about these blue zones is that in those places, which typically is the place where you grew up your entire life, multi-generational families live together, you're with the same people growing up your entire life. And as a result of that, everyone knows everything about you as a human being, and the good and the bad, and they accept you. They don't judge you. You're accepted with every part of you. In modern society, we often aren't with any of our relatives. We often are by ourselves. We don't know a lot of people. And what happens in those environments is that you create a projection of your best self, and you don't show your own vulnerability. And as a result, you're carrying a shield to try to protect yourself. And the thing, though, is that when you put that shield up, you're not vulnerable. Yet it is vulnerability that connects us and that others intuit from us to care back. And when you're in the presence of someone like the Dalai Lama or some of these other really iconic spiritual leaders, you are accepted unconditionally and given love. You know you're not being judged. And when you don't have to worry about being judged, you don't have to worry about what people think of you, and that they understand that all of us has a dark side. When you are able to sit with that, it's like a weight has been lifted off your shoulders, and suddenly you just feel pure, absolute joy and love. And it's an extraordinary experience. And while not all of us can be right there, we can aspire towards that so that when we interact with a patient, we are not judging them on whether they have insurance, their race, their socioeconomic status. We simply know it's another human being, and we look at them as an equal. We don't look down at them. We are equals. When you can do that, the very nature of having that radiance about you, that acceptance, that non-judgment, changes the paradigm interaction for the better. And that's what it's like to be in the presence of someone like the Dalai Lama. You are free because you're loved for who you are.
Well, we need to thank you, Dr. James Doty, for loving your patients, loving your listeners, and teaching people of all persuasions and all languages about compassion and altruism and empathy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and it's really a joy to be with both of you, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you for your powerful words.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health for the House Call segment of our show today. Roberto and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And Roberto, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
It's been about 7 years since I had my last tetanus shot. I do a lot of woodworking, and I'm constantly getting tiny cuts, scrapes, etc. I know traditionally you get a tetanus shot every 10 years, but should I request one more frequently, given the fact that I often have wounds, even if they're just minor?
So many of us get scrapes, and sometimes more serious. It just seems like to happen. And we're trying to remember when your last tetanus. That's not so straightforward for a lot of people.
That's right. I don't think I know the answers to this one. I know from working in the emergency department, if you have a cut and you're not sure when your last vaccine was of your tetanus, you're going to get one. But if you're 100% sure that it's within the 7 years, I would think you're covered.
Or 10 years. 10 years, actually. Yeah, I think you are covered there. sometimes people trying to remember, did they ever actually get a tetanus vaccination? So sometimes that's a real question. And then you may have to go through immunization. And then if you weren't certain or it's been more than that time and you have a really bad cut, you might have to get immune globulin. You might have to actually get this tetanus immune globulin to also cover you in the short term, perhaps while the booster is there. On the other hand, you don't need to be getting it every 2 or 3 years every time you get a bad cut. The biggest risk would be that cut gets infected, not that you get tetanus, which is a very rare thing.
Correct.
What's our very next house call?
I have anxiety, and a family member has been strongly encouraging me to start meditating. I already do yoga. Are there other benefits I might see by finding time specifically to meditate?
Well, that was our guest today. What do you think Dr. Jody would say, Roberto?
Start meditating right now. Don't waste any time. I think, you know, honestly, I've tried meditating in the past, and when you keep up with it, it works. It helps with stress. It helps with anxiety. And it does not take that much time. Right now, I'm relying on an app called Headspace. It's actually free to download. And the very first section of it, it's the basics to meditation. So for somebody that has never meditated before, it just takes you through the basic steps. And it starts at 5 minutes a day. And I think it's wonderful. And there is evidence. There was an article published in JAMA in 2013 that showed that there is moderate evidence that meditation does help reduce stress, anxiety.
I totally agree. And actually, I want to give a shout out right now to my daughter, Eliana, who on, I believe, her college essay, she just graduated from the University of North Carolina, talked about how yoga really brought the family together. She was really the first one in our family that started doing it. And we all started doing it. And it's great to see a family that when we go on vacation, we look to do yoga as much as we look to play golf or tennis. Really, I can't agree with you more, Roberto. It takes practice, but it can be done in 10 or 15 seconds to an hour or more. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I'm a woman in my 40s who is just beginning to experience menopause. How do I know if or when I should start to consider hormone replacements?
Well, first off, it's a good question. And early 40s is a little young for most women to be having menopause. So I guess one of our real questions, if we heard this, someone coming into our office, we'd probably do some simple blood test or maybe a little more history to find out if indeed it really is menopause.
That's right. I think that would be step one. In my 2 years of experience practicing as a resident physician, I've had a few patients with this issue. And I think what this patient is mostly talking about is I'm having symptoms of menopause that I can't handle. And that's probably going to be just hot flashes. As far as treatment for that, we're talking about hormone replacement therapy, specifically estrogen. Now, there are a lot of contraindications to starting estrogen, such as breast cancer, heart disease, blood clots, even liver disease. But I think once you get down and really try to sit down with your physician, he's going to ask the questions and really try to figure out if your symptoms are just something that you are not able to deal with, and you'll come up with a decision together.
And there are some non-hormone replacement for the kind of those vasomotor, those hot flashes, including some oral medications. There's an antidepressant that can also be useful. So I think the bottom line, just as you said, Roberta, is sit down, talk with your physician, because it's an informed decision to start hormone replacement, which is commonly done, but also can have some people for whom it's not the right therapy. So good luck. And we want to thank all of our listeners today for their questions. We hope they've been a benefit to you and your health. If any listener wants to share a question or story, they can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. They can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. James Doty. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Roberto Rupsich.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.